Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish the book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. Joining me today, like normal, is Juliana.
Hello, everyone.
And it's weird trying to say that in the opening patter in a different vibe.
In a different diction.
In a different way to put the emphasis on different words. Anyway, so on my last work trip, it was a two-week cruise.
Yes.
Spent 7 days at sea, not seeing land for 7 days to get across the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
Although I guess we did get to see the Azores when they brought the immigration guys on, to Portuguese immigration guys on. Either way, doesn't matter about that. So I was away for a long time. I was thinking maybe I'd do a solo episode.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, these days I've got these reading projects where I'm like, hey, I'll read a book, maybe I've read it before, checking out for the SFBIP must reads list. And this time, yes, I did read an old book, two old books actually, to check them out to see if they deserve their place on the SFBIP must reads list or not.
And?
Let's separate out the two kind of different reading projects that have gone. We'll talk about that in a future episode when we talk about the SFBIP must reads list, because then it'll be relevant to whatever future book we talk about there, or past book that we talk, relevant to the long-term relevant reading program, which is the SFBIP must reads list.
Yes.
Also, at the same time as this, I'm going through the best books from last year. This is the other thing that I'm doing, is checking out new books which were recommended. So I'm not just reading like the best books from like the 1960s and 1980s and 1990s and other things. They're like, what's the best books from 2025?
Yeah.
So I've made this list. I've talked about it in some previous episodes. For example, and this was compiled from other people's best of the year lists, books lists.
So it's already a best of the best of.
So it's other people who read an entire year's worth of new books and said, these are the ones that stand out. And then I've gone through lots of different people's lists, who end of year lists and blogs and podcasts and, you know, Twitter, not Twitter, Blue Sky and other things like that, where people post their end of year best ofs. And these are the books that come up numerous times and that appeal to me.
Yeah.
Notes from a Regicide by Isaac Fellman. Haven't got to that one yet. A Granite Silence by Nina Allen. Haven't got to that one yet. Not quite sure how science fiction-y it is, either way. Shroud by Adrian Tchaikovsky was on the previous list, on a list that I was probably going to get to anyway.
Yeah.
I talked about that one on episode 582. Slow Gods by Claire North. Talked about that on 583.
Yes.
Halcyon Years by Alistair Reynolds. Talked about that one on 584.
Yeah.
The Everlasting by Alex Harrow. Didn't finish that one and talked about it on episode. Oh, I didn't make a note of this one. When did we talk about The Everlasting? 580, episode 580.
Okay.
So these are ones that I've already got to. Then there's Rakes Fall by Vira Chandrasekara. Haven't read that one yet. Haven't tried it yet.
Okay.
It's on hold in the library app, though.
Good.
Luminous by Sylvia Park. Spoilers, this episode. The Incandescent by Emily Tesh. Didn't get into that one because I realized, this book's not for me. Noped out of it. No episode
happens.
About that one.
Yep.
The Expansion Project by Ben Pester. Haven't found it available anywhere. I realize that might be self-published, whatever.
Okay.
Anibot. Noped out of that one. No episode about that one. But I have mentioned it on a previous podcast, I think.
You did, yes.
And then there's another one which was on my to-read list. And I thought it was an older book. And I got confused, so I left it off this list earlier. But now I've looked it up. It turns out there is no anti-mimetics division by someone who goes by Quantum, like a pen name, a four-letter Quantum. I thought it was an older book, but people were talking about it. They put it on their best of the 2025 list, and I didn't understand it, so I left it off. But now I've done some research. It was self-published in 2020. And then last year, it had a proper, you know, like Penguin, Random House, whatever it was.
It got discovered by the big publishing houses.
Yes, it was published by Ballantine and Penguin. And then, but earlier on, there's like a Kindle edition, like obviously a self-published Kindle edition.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if it's been changed in this reprinting, but this is now added to, now I'm like, I'll actually get to read it, because it was like an old book or like a 5-6 year old book, which I thought, maybe I'll get to it one day.
But now it's available.
But now it's on the list because it's actually been published properly. And that's why now I understand why it was included on people's best of the year list or interesting books that they read last year.
Okay.
So I will get to that at some point.
Yes.
So those are the things that those are the sort of like the current best of 2025 reading project.
Yes.
So didn't do an episode about the book Anniebot, but I think I mentioned it on a previous podcast.
Yes, you certainly did.
Talking about how I didn't have faith that the author would be able to have full control over the subject matter, the science fictional subject matter, the thematic, you know, thematic subject matter, yeah, the story, the characters and everything like that. I just went into it and I immediately had massive qualms about the writing quality and the storytelling quality and just, you know, generally like this book is not going to be for me.
Yeah.
Even if one of these things is amazing, it's being let down in so many other ways. And so that was Anniebot out of here. And that won like the Arthur C. Clarke Award. It was very, you know, highly like it's already an awards winning-ish book. But I didn't finish it.
Yeah,
in fact,
happens.
I didn't even get to the end of the first. I think that, you know, I read like a few scenes of the book. I don't even know if I got to the end of the first chapter, but a few scenes of the book. On the other hand, there's also a book about a sex robot called Luminous by Sylvia Park, today's episode.
Yeah.
And as a book, as Anniebot was a book that I noped out of immediately.
Yeah.
Sylvia Park wrote a book called Luminous, which is also about robots, that I fell in love with the robots and found absolutely fascinating.
Nice.
And spoilers, might be a 5-star book, probably not a 5-star book, but like super high level, like I really enjoyed this book.
That's amazing.
Maybe a bit too long. So this comes back to the point where you were saying, hey, you've not read any good books recently.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I read a good book. Like we were talking about new books and like old books. And you're like, well, the new ones aren't very good. And I think it was like just on the last episode, I was talking, well, we've got to come up with Sturgeon's Law that 90% of everything is going to be crap.
Yeah.
10% of stuff is going to be, 9% of stuff is going to be good. And 1% of stuff is going to be great.
Outstanding.
And outstanding. Yeah. 5 stars, you know.
Yeah.
And this book is, so far, the best book that I read from last year.
Nice.
Including other books which I gave like 4.5 stars to, which include Shroud by Adrian Tchaikovsky, which was on this list. And also, what was the book that we read? The When There Are Wolves Again. You also read that one. 4.5 stars.
Yeah.
Very good book. This book is definitely in the running for best book of last year alongside Shroud. I think it's better than Shroud, and it's doing different things than both of these books.
Nice.
It's science fiction in different directions. So,
I like that. It's it gives it more variety in the topics that we're reading.
Yeah, yeah, which is really good because since we've done this, the Hugo Awards nominations have come out. And again, I don't read books because they're on the Hugo Awards. I don't do the award reading. I'll leave that up to other podcasts and other bloggers and stuff like that. No, well, look, but again, it is a signal that people, like, what do people think are good? And this is quite interesting because one of the books on there I've actually finished, which is Shroud by Adrian Tchaikovsky.
Yep.
Thought it was very good. Three other books, Death of the Author, didn't finish, noped out of. The Everlasting by Alex E. Harrow, got a long way into that one as well, didn't finish it. The Incandescent by Emily Tesh, again, I've got nothing against the book. I noped out of it because it wasn't for me, not because the quality wasn't there.
Yeah.
But Death of the Author and The Everlasting are trying to do things which I think just aren't working very well at all.
Yeah.
And then there's like two fantasy books, The Raven Scholar, which was mentioned to us by someone who sent us an email.
Yes.
A podcast, emailer, Alex. Thank you very much, Alex Payne, for sending us an email. He said, I've been listening for 17 years.
She said.
It's what?
She said. She's,
is it Alex? Alex. Probably she. Who knows? Juliana, you might like The Raven Scholar. It's fantasy with a murder mystery. It's fab. Thanks, says Alex. So
that it's on my to read list.
So and it had already been on my to read list as one of these books from last year, but it was fantasy, so it wasn't like included in this one. But now it's definitely going to go on the to read list. The Raven Scholar, and then there's like a fantasy story, A Drop of Corruption by Robert Jackson Bennett, which is like a second book in a series. I'm never gonna if you awards nominate a second book in a series.
Yeah.
I'm just not gonna get to it at all.
Yeah.
So
It doesn't make sense. Like, either you recommend you nominate one that's starting off a series, or you nominate a series, but the second book in the series.
Anyway, skipping over all of that, what I'm trying to say is 3 of the 6 books recommended, I didn't finish. And these are Hugo Award nominated. They had 1,150 people nominated these books.
Yeah.
And at least 120, between 126 to 210 people think one of these books is one of their top books of the year last year. Which again, is a very small size. It's a very small. You know, we run the top. I run the top 40 jugglers of the year.
Yes.
The voting is about the same.
Yeah.
For like who gets to the top of the number, who becomes the number one juggler of the year.
Yeah.
Is around about the same level of engagement, fan engagement and voting than the Hugo Award nomination. Maybe, I guess the finalists, like once you actually get to the final votes, there's a lot more people voting.
Yeah.
But in the nominations process, which is a similar thing that you can list more than one people, like more than one, it's like ranked choice or whatever it is.
Yes. So, now that's quite interesting because of course the group of interested people in the top 40s is much smaller.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying is that the number of people who vote in something that like a popularity contest that I run, which is the top 40 jugglers of the year,
yes,
is around about the same range. Again, there's more people. It says 1,153 ballots cast. So that's more people than vote. But I'm saying actually how many votes were done in these, which is 210 people thought that at least one of these books was the best book of the year, is a similar voting range for, you know, Spencer Andrioli being the best juggler of the year last year, or Delaney Baylor's being the year before, you know, whatever it is. Excuse me. So either way, it's a small signal that 210 people find that book good, considering that like one person emailing me gets a book to the top of the list, top of my reading list, quicker than a book being nominated on the SF on the Hugo Awards. It gets to get a book onto the SFBRP. It's someone personally emailing me is going to be a higher rate, a hit rate than a Hugo nomination. Anyway, 12 minutes into this podcast, let's get to today's books. I'm just saying it's all in just a setup that not all new books are shit. There are some good books each coming out each year, but it might be in the range of 3 good books per year.
Yes, and you have to make your way through the books that are not great to find the one...
Very specifically for me, not make my way through the book.
Yeah.
Give up halfway through, give up a third of the way through, or give up after the first, you know, chapter and a half.
Totally fine
as well.
It's
totally fine. Anyway, here we go. Luminous, Sylvia Park. This book is set, I was going to say near future, but let's say future enough that some things are still relevant to today.
Okay.
Like some world politics are recognizable and relevant, and some cultural things are recognizable and relevant, rooted in today, but far enough ahead that there's been massive technological leaps in some areas.
Right.
And also politics has changed enough that things can be a bit weird.
Okay.
So this is set in a reunified Korea. So there's no longer North Korea or South Korea, but there kind of is, because the North Korea is still a bit of a dump and not many people there. And there's kind of like immigration controls between the two sides of the country. There's mentions about like one country, two systems, which is kind of like Hong Kong and China as well. Like, no, we're one country. We're just going to have two political systems. But then the political systems come closer together and not in one direction.
Yeah.
And what's really great about this, it's never really explained what the politics were. It's just kind of stated, oh yeah, we're now reunified. And I was like, did it ever mention, did like the South take over the North or the North take over the South? Or like, was it like the, you know, or they rewrote the constitution to like Star also includes East Germany, you know, like kind of Germany reunification. So there's all this kind of stuff. But the great thing about this book is that a lot of the viewpoint characters are children who just don't know. They're just this is just the world that they're living
clever.
In. And they just don't know anything. And then also the people who, the viewpoint characters who we do, the adult viewpoint characters that we do follow are this brother and sister pairing who also they went over to America because I think their father was American or was part of, you know, whatever. So they went over to America and kind of grew up as teenagers in America and that now are back in Korea but aren't quite sure, like, oh, what's my heritage, you know, like there's the two main characters is Morgan. And she works for a robot company as a robot personality programmer. But she is like, oh yeah, but I don't really feel Korean because like I grew up in America and I've lost my Korean. Mm-hmm. Like all the Korean that I spoke is really difficult, and she struggles with her Korean language and stuff like that. But then June, her brother, was a bit older, so kept his Korean, but then is like disconnected in other ways as well, like that. And and there's obviously war and fighting between, you know, the North and South Korea, and there was some, you know, robot massacre that happened, that and all these other kind of things. So there was robot warfare going on too. But you know, it's sort of like, so wait, and I was like, did it ever mention who won? But in the end, that's not the important part. It's sort of like, the important part is like, what's happening right now? So that's the setup. There is a various different robot companies. One is called, did I make a note of it here? Oh, yeah, Imagine Friends. So it's a robot company called Imagine Friends, and they have different lines of robots. They, of course, have the sex robot, housewife robot that you can get, a bit like the Anibot character. Yeah. But also you get the boyfriend robot, the hunky man robot kind of guy. And then you have different kid robots. You've got like the kid robot called Ellie, who is a the girl robot, and then there's the boy robot. So Imagine Friends always has like four or five different models that they're working on, you know.
Okay.
And it's very like iPhone like, oh, this year the new model's gonna have this feature and stuff. So that's the kind of setup, and just in a world building kind of thing. This is very Blade Runner in a way, kind of like a bit dystopian. There was like a scrapyard where they get together old robots. There's old robot parts there as well, and then they have like a robot fighting arena. You know that in the movie AI, artificial intelligence, which started off as Stanley Kubrick movie, ended up as Steven Spielberg movie, and all that kind of, this is very AI, artificial intelligence, with, you know, there's a young boy who is like a robot and passing as a human, but sort of like, and the whole kind of thing in there was sort of like, oh, you're real, like you don't have a real family, so getting this robot boy, and they can stay a boy that you can, or a girl that you can care for this entire time, and then as soon as you have a real child, you just like kick them out, and then they're like out and about by themselves. This book is playing in the same space. Okay, something really went wrong with your microphone, so I just want to make a note here. Okay. And we're back. Hopefully I solved the microphone stuff. Don't touch your microphone. Anyway, so what I'm trying to say is it's kind of like, you know, there's parts which are like, oh, there's the, you know, the, is it Jude Law who's in that movie?
Yeah, it's Jude Law.
There's a good looking sex robot, and you know, he's like a sexy gigolo robot, I think, in that one as well.
Yeah.
And also there's those scenes where you have like, and now the robots fight each other, and now we get the robots and we smash them up. This book is playing in that same space of like, if robots are all around us and part of the real world, how do we treat the robots? It's very Blade Runner in this way as well, with Blade Runner being that, like, the way that you test if someone's a robot or not is like the, was it the Voight-Kampff test or something like that, which is the empathy thing. So like, oh, you see a turtle laying on its back, do you kick the turtle or do you leave it there, or is there a big, and it's like this empathy test kind of thing, whereas actually a big part of it is like what makes us humans is empathy. But then you see people treating the robots badly and you're like, okay, empathy,
where's your empathy now?
Where is your empathy? So there's a lot of Blade Runner playing in the Blade Runner space. Also, the writing of the book is very Philip K. Dick like as well in some ways, which is very free, very like, here's an idea, oh, we just mention this and move on. Like Philip K. Dick is always sort of like, yeah, something something, oh, the colony on Mars, something something, or, you know, like in The Man in the High Castle, where it's sort of like, yeah, and then they drained the Mediterranean Sea because they wanted more land, and then just move on, and you're like, wait, go back a bit, like, wait a second, what's happening here, like that. And it's sort of like the world building is so much from the point of view of the characters that whatever they feel is like normal just gets mentioned or whatever, but then what they're concentrating on struggling with can be something really small, like in the case of a Philip K. Dick, like Ubik or whatever it is, where they're like, oh, I've got to put some money in the meter to be able to open
shower.
No, to open my door. The lock on my door has a subscription service to it. And you're like, oh, Philip K. Dick was writing this in like 1971.
He knew what's happening.
And then in the future, like these, you know, Internet of Things or, smart home appliances, you're like, oh, yeah, and you didn't keep it your subscription, so now you can't unlock your front door because, you know, and you're like, oh, right.
Yes.
So
I want to say, I know you have your things, but no, I want to say something here. Yeah. It feels very much like there's a certain art, like in my head, these kind of what you just said about how they describe the world building feels very much like an art style. You know, some is a bit more impressionistic.
Yes. And I've made that note here in my
and
in my
some
right,
is
in my
more
notes here.
Like, okay, we are going for hyper realistic, and this is more like I'm just mentioning things here to give it a background color and shape.
So I'm going to read out my notes that I made like 2 weeks ago when I was reading this. I said, it's very good. It's a bit clever in places, but refreshing. So it's a refreshing voice. I said, it's impressionistic. A few words here and there paint a picture. Not all the details are needed. Very Philip K. Dick. Mm-hmm. And it is so refreshing to read something that somebody writes who can just... Again, you can see that they're working on it, but the output of what they're working on is actually refreshingly easy to read. I read this as an ebook as a library book, borrowed book. I'm not sure it would work quite as well as an audio book because sometimes there'll just be like a sentence fragment of someone's thought that you just think and then move on from it. And you're like, wait, how is that connected? And the conversations are very much from the point of view of the people, like conversations going on. And then if somebody just doesn't pay attention to the conversation
we also don't get that.
We just don't get it. And they're like, oh, what are we talking about now? Oh, great. And then you just, and the whole thing is sort of like whatever someone's concentrating on, it works really well. So that's a bit about the writing, a bit about the world building. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the characters. So there's like three to four main characters. The main family unit is Morgan, who is, like I say, it creates the
personality
programmer, and she's working officially at work on a new boy robot, which is going to be released later in the year.
Yeah,
and that's kind of what the story revolves around, or one of the story threads is there's a new robot coming out, and so of course the big finale takes place at the big, you know, like the new iPhone announcement there.
The big event.
Yeah, you know, it's the big event. There's like a big tech conference, and they're going to get, you know, Steve Jobs or whoever it's going to be up on stage. Oh no, not the Steve Jobs, because there's actually in the backstory of this is there's like a Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak kind of founding pair to imagine friends, and one of them has died. And that's like the Steve Jobs guy. But then the Steve Wozniak guy, who was like the technical person, left the company earlier and is working on research projects, mostly robot animals instead. Uh-huh. So there's also a bit of Blade Runner in there as well. Like, oh, that's a nice owl that you've got there. Yeah. You know, or whatever the thing is in the book, you know.
The unicorn.
No, the unicorn's a dream thing. Don't worry about it. In the book, there's a sheep. Someone's like, can I afford a sheep? Is that sheep going to be the robot animal that I'm going to have here? So yeah, definitely very knowingly this person is now going to work on robot animals rather than humans. Mm-hmm. But when Morgan and Jun, Jun is the brother, but is a trans character who used a war injury, an explosive bomb that went off, which was being carried by a robot, destroyed at the time her body, and she then became trans and rebuilt herself with a male body and now identifies for the entirety of the book as male.
Okay.
But it's a big part is that kind of like the rebuilding yourself, I'm more robot than I am human. You know, the whole cyborg thing.
Yeah, sort of
like how much of a human do you have to replace?
Yes.
And part of Jun that's been replaced is the male identity has been like robotically adjusted to, you know, transitioned into male.
Okay.
Sorry, female. She was female.
Yes.
He, okay, trans. It's difficult to do. And the fun thing is that even in the book, the characters are sometimes struggling with this. When the parent was sort of like, oh yeah, my one daughter, you know, there's these different things go on there. But again, the book is very like focused on this as well. The gender identity. It's kind of, I know it's weird to say this, I've talked about this in a lot of ways that like now you have to have, like in all these modern books, there seems to be like, and then there'll be a trans character for reasons which seem more to do with the political situation in 2025 that the authors want to have a trans character in there rather than it becoming a thing which is science fictional or, you know, character based or anything like that. And this book is really, really, it's a really fun exploration of gender alongside robotics and cybernetics and, yeah, and all these other things.
It makes sense. Like, it's this kind of question of, if you could start over, why not choose a different kind of identity? I totally understand that, and it makes a lot of sense to then say, okay, why can I now get a different experience in life. Yeah.
And again, I'm not giving away anything which isn't in the first two chapters here. Jun works for the Robot Crimes Division, which is a very like Philip K. Dick kind of style thing, sort of like, all right, so if a robot goes missing, we're the one who tracks them down. You know, it's sort of like, it's like, am I an insurance investigator or should I work for real crimes? But no, I'm doing robot crimes. And it turns out in the whole city, there's only two people who work for robot crimes because people don't care about the robots.
Yes.
Or not enough. But anyway, a robot goes missing, and it's gone missing before, but now it's gone missing again. And Jun is trying to track down Ellie, who is a little girl robot.
Yeah.
And there's always a thing sort of like, oh, well, did it run away because it was being abused by a male thing? There's, oh, is it going to be a creep? And so the first time when June returned, the robot knocked on the door, but then didn't stick around to see who it was, because it had been heartbreaking if it had been an older man opened the door and took in the young girl robot and was like, thanks for my robot back again, and closed the door. And it turns out it wasn't that, but this kind of stuff is a big part in the world, is that... If sex robots exist and child robots exist,
yes,
is there a crossover in that way? And Imagine Friends, the company, is like, no. The young boys and girls are meant to be lovable and all that kind of stuff. And it's the older robots, but there is this crossover kind of thing, which is a bit of a pity. Morgan, the sister, who is the robot personality technician, also has a home project, a side project, which is Steven. And Steven is her boyfriend robot that she's got at home.
Yeah.
And she started the personality again from scratch with Steven, basing it on some kind of like someone who was a child actor who then grew up and was then a male actor. And she was, that was the teenage crush of Morgan.
Would it be if you could be together with your teenage crush?
And so she's modeled the looks and the personality on the film characters of this teenage crush kind of person going on.
Yeah.
Steven is maybe one of my favorite characters in science fiction that I've read recently.
Okay.
So much fun because he wants to be the best possible boyfriend.
Aww.
And is programmed to be the best possible boyfriend. But Morgan at one point is like, nah, I think we should just be friends. Now, imagine, and what makes this character so great is that he speed runs the young male disillusioned about the world, disillusioned about women, incel, like what is it, what does incel stand for? Involuntary celibacy.
Yes. Yeah.
So he speed runs the whole thing, like in months, and he gets to the point where he's reprogramming himself to forget that he was dumped by it, because it's so heartbreaking, and the foundation of his personality is that he should be someone's boyfriend. And she's sort of like, no, you're just going to be a friend, and you're just going to help, you're just going to be my servant robot and companion robot now. Okay. And you're just going to be, and it destroys, and he goes deep into men's rights things. He goes along to the, like, you know, like the game, is it the game, the book where it's like the dating profile about how you should neg women and all that kind of stuff, and he gets deep into that, passing himself off as human, but going to what was it, who that we just watched that thing, so Andrew Tate style,
manosphere,
yeah, the man macho, he's wanting to not be a cuck as much as possible. And it's such a fun character that this fragile male ego, which has been programmed that way by somebody who's just experimenting, sort of like, oh, let's experiment with someone's personality, like this Morgan, who's, you know, who's actually a very good at her job, like a side project. Like, someone's personality can't be a side project and you think it's just going to be great and be like, oh no, that's fine and whatever. Anyway, it's so much fun. Now, this feels like there's a lot going on in this book, and that is what makes this book so great, is that there are so many dynamics and so many things going on that, like, I can read into all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I read other people's reviews, and a lot of this stuff isn't mentioned in the reviews. And they're mentioning other stuff going on in different directions. And I was like, oh, that's how, for me, a book suddenly becomes like a 5-star book contender.
Yeah.
When I can finish a book, have like 18 takes about the book. It can talk about politics. It can talk about, you know, relationships. It can talk about family. It can talk about gender. It can talk about all of this kind of stuff. It can be like, you would think that somebody read Anibot and was like, wait, that's, no, you can't just have like a superhuman robot suddenly turn up and the rest of the world isn't affected. Like, how is the rest of the world different now that there are robots in it? And North Korea, like in Korea, is sort of like, yeah, it's robots made it so, you know, we could fight wars without endangering this, and we could just, you know, there's just so much craziness in this book.
Yeah, because it kind of shows that for any sort of world building and character, there has to be purpose. You can't just, you know, like,
even if there's not purpose, there has to be something
purpose
to it.
Purpose and impact, maybe.
Which makes it feel as though there has been an impact somewhere.
Yeah.
Stuff you can't just be like, oh, whatever, like that. Anyway, other characters in here as well is Ruiji, who is a small, who they're the two characters who we follow who are children, is Ruiji, who she has like an exoskeleton because she's like, she's got a terminal illness, but it's a brain illness. Just, they can't just replace parts of her and it works out. So her parents are like, hey, you can have a robot, but like a robot exoskeleton, which will help you get around. And she's in a wheelchair. Mm. And so there's a lot of anguish there. And then Taiwan, who is a kid whose mother is back in North Korea, but she left him behind in South Korea, and he lives with his uncle Wonsuk, and Wonsuk is like, has a is someone who like steals robots sometimes, but it's not really, not quite sure, sell them off to, oh, Mr. Mo, that's like the Andrew Tate style or whatever it is, like, I'm gonna teach you how to be a real man, come along to my dating workshop. And the dating workshop is sort of like how to date rape somebody, you know, it's literally that kind of thing. And you're like, oof, Stephen, Mr. Mo is not the leader that you need here. He's not the teacher that you need. And then they come across this, a robot boy called Yo-Yo. And Yo-Yo is like the glue that holds all these different things, all these different characters together.
Yeah.
Which is a robot based on a childhood companion robot that the Steve Wozniak father figure created for the two children who are now the adults. So the main theme, the main core of this book is, you know, childhood expectations of family, brother and sister, sister and sister, brother who's a robot who you're growing up with, who was your hero that you looked up to as you grew up, and they stayed the same age, the dynamics changed in that way. There's the like Pinocchio of it all, and there's other, you know, recurring stories about, you know, like who are you basing these things on, and what the character is as well.
Yeah,
so that's a lot of stuff going on there. And because every single one of these characters kind of bumps into one of the other characters at some point, you're like, oh, so when Steven meets Taewon, what's it going to be like? When Taewon meets Ellie, what's it going to be like? When Ryuji meets Morgan, what's it going to be like? When,
there's lots of options.
Yeah, so there's like these, I would say like 6-7 main characters who each bump up against each of the other ones, and then the father comes back, and another character comes back, and a journalist can turn up, and another police officer can be there doing stuff.
So how does the inner circle react to each other, and then how do those react to the outside?
I wouldn't even say that there's an inner circle, because some of them like don't meet, or if they do, they just like, oh, they see someone that's, oh, that person saw someone from behind and then moved on, and they were like, wait, was that the same person? Yeah, like, so it's not like they all know each other.
No, but from our perspective.
Yes, from our perspective, yeah. Like the core, core
that we
of the novel.
Spend with the people we spend time with. Yeah.
And there's other kids and there's other adults as well, but that's a big part of it. So let me roll down to, all right, so that's all the setup to what I think now is going to be the most important part of the book. Or one of the reasons why I think this book works so well is you would think that this book, which is so much about robots and so much about what it's like to be a robot and so much about the character stories of the character arcs of the robots and the main characters and the characters who do some of the most important things are the robots. None of the point of view characters are robots themselves. Some of them are like part robots, cyborgs or whatever, but they are human characters with human lives and human desires and human wants and human motivations and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Humans are our storytelling stuff, which is a massive contrast to so much other science fiction, which is like, all right, I want to talk about, I want to tell a story from the point of view of a robot. Now, yeah, let's bring it back over to the last book that we talked about, which was Episode List. The last book
of
we talked
Monsters
about.
Monsters and Mainframes?
Of Monsters and Mainframes by Barbara Truelove, which you gave 1 star to.
Yeah.
You said that one of the things which was so difficult to get into was that it was all written from the point of view of what? A spaceship with a personality talking to a sub-personality of theirs, which was also a robot.
No, it was from different perspectives.
Oh, okay.
But none of them were human.
Okay. None of them were human. Oh, right. So none of them were human. They were all other from us. But... and here's the thing, which comes up in a lot of these books where suddenly you talk, where you have other like non-human people telling the story. And this is one of the things about Anibot. I was like, I don't believe that I'm reading the first person or even the close third person thought processes of how a robot thinks. Now, there's ways to get around this in fiction. One of them is that we're not seeing the thoughts of a robot. Maybe a robot or an alien or someone else who has learned the language of human language and human words and human storytelling mm-hmm. tells their story from their point of view. Like, hey, I'm telling you a story. Mm-hmm. But that is then a conceit of the novel. There has to be, I wouldn't say there has to be, but there will be some kind of frame story around a bit.
Yeah.
You know, like, here is this robot telling us this. Here is a ship telling us this. This is a report from here. This has been translated from whatever alien slash fantasy slash robot slash cybernetic viewpoint that it's coming from.
Yeah.
Then we're getting it in, now we're getting it in English, which is what Barbara Truelove was hinting at in her book where it opens with 11001010110, which is the worst, shittiest way of saying, hey, this is all written by from the point of view of a robot.
Or an AI. AI ship mind, yeah.
But we already know in 2025 that robots don't think in zeros and ones anymore. Because, let me just say, modern technology, LLMs, large language models, they actually think in the tokens, you know, when you hear about AI tokens,
yeah.
Those tokens are little bits of human word, like alphabets of like phrases or like, you know, what make, like syllables is what a token is. And so the unit of thought of modern computers or large language artificial intelligence, as we know it now with, you know, OpenAI and Claude and all that kind of stuff, isn't 10011001. That isn't how they think. They actually think in human comprehensible letters.
Okay.
Which are called tokens.
I thought that when they run the experiment of having two of those talk to each other, humans were not able to...
Oh, yes, okay. That's a different kind of thing. What I'm saying is these robot AIs work better if we don't restrict them to human language.
Yeah.
When they start developing their own way of like, how can I think about maths much better? But what they don't think in is binary. They think in calculatable, recognizable collections. And of course, underneath those things are ones and zeros.
Yeah.
Like each letter is then represented by ones and zeros. But the layer that they're actually thinking in is kind of making connections between things, and the things that they're making connection between aren't ones and zeros. Of course, everything underneath is ones and zeros, but that's like saying everything under in humans' like, brains is
like blood and oxygen.
Yeah, it's blood and oxygen and little chemicals and firing stuff like that. So let's abstract from the base layer up. One is actually so, but like I say, it's not natural. Like I don't believe. You know, it's put it this way. It's very difficult for me to believe in fiction that somebody is truly not human, but then see close third person describing their thoughts about something.
Yeah.
And if their thoughts, if put it this way, if I, as a human English reader, can understand the thoughts of something, it's not alien enough.
Yeah.
And so much science fiction thinks that, oh, I'll just have them. And, you know, it goes to aliens, it goes to AI, it goes to robots, all these kind of stuff. And not the genius, but what I most appreciate about this book is that Stephen is a great character. We never see anything from his point of view. It's all from Morgan's point of view and Jun's point of view, and the other point, the other human characters describe, like, noticing things he's doing, describing things that he's doing, talking, analyzing him from the point of view of someone who is a professional robot brain programmer, personality developer, describing from the point of view of someone who goes on a date with him, you know, describing him from the point of view of someone who sees him around and doesn't know that he's doesn't know that he's a robot and thinks he's a human because he's passing himself off because he's a homemade robot,
yeah,
and his plug isn't in the normal place. There's a TV show called Where's My Plug, and the whole point of it is like a Blade Runner kind of thing, where you're like, is this person, like, which one of these people is a robot, you know? And as each episode goes on, someone else gets voted off, and it's like that kind of mafia werewolf kind of thing, that if the last person is a robot, that's good slash bad, whatever.
Yeah,
like,
it's, you won.
Yeah, and yeah, it's kind of, anyway, so a book where the point of view characters are all human, but the book is so much about what it means to be a robot. But all of the robot stuff doesn't come through the robot's point of view and the robot describing what their childhood was like and the robot describing what their thought process is like and the robot doing this. No, it's all reflected through human cognition,
yeah,
and arrives via the book into my brain as human cognition. All right, go again.
Two things. This kind of thing that you just described...
Yeah,
with that we get to experience the world through humans,
yeah,
makes it approachable and for us. No, that's not the right word. It makes it we can feel it because we are humans.
Yeah,
and as much as we can imagine something and be creative, we are always human. So if you then get the story funneled through other human,
yeah,
experiences, you feel like you can how do you say,
empathize?
Yes, and also, yeah, empathize, and also there's another word. Yeah, anyway, it is something that we can
sympathize
with. Yes.
Yeah. So this is okay.
And the other thing is that there are only maybe in all of book writing history, or the books that I've read, yeah, let me put it this way, the more the books that I have read, there is maybe one or two people who actually have the ability to create a world and make it believable enough so that they can write an AI, a robot, or an alien, so that I think, oh, they understand what it means to be so different,
yeah,
to a human, that I totally get that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is like very rare.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes this book stand out. It's a book which understands the Blade Runner test.
Yes.
The test which is about empathy.
Yeah.
Empathy, which means that we can't, like, it's very difficult for humans to empathize with robots, or for them to come back again.
Yeah.
Because we're mutually non-understandable. But it's like, what am I trying to say? Okay, talking about Anibot, which again is a very recent book,
yeah,
which is fresh in my mind because, yeah, it did this kind of stuff so badly that because there was like, I was up against the bare metal of Anibot's internal monologue,
yeah,
or dialogue or thought process.
Yeah.
There was no way for me to separate out any possible humanity from her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can, so that means I'm just judging the thing, the object.
Yes.
Its worth by how well do I think they are passing as a human?
Yeah.
And if they write, and this is, again, this is via an author doing a bad job of writing it, but that somebody can write something, and I think that isn't a convincing enough depiction of what a robot should think like.
Yeah.
Therefore, I don't believe that they exist. Like, they seem too fictional to me. suddenly I can't have empathy for them.
Yes.
You know, I can't.
You don't connect.
I don't connect because their thought process is too recognizably human, but then written badly. And the same thing happens to me. You know, you reread and I started rereading A Long Way to a Small Angry Planet.
Yeah.
And in that one, there was like this sexy lizard alien that the captain has an affair with or something like that. And they're like, oh, yes, and these two people. Yeah. It's like, these two people can just get along with it. I'm like, how? Like, what? And I was like, no. Yeah. If the alien is so human that all of their emotions can map onto human emotions one-to-one, and I'm like, no, I don't believe it. Like, I just don't believe it. And I can't relate to the relationship that a captain of a starship has with a sexy lizard alien if the lizard alien is, like, just a human with a lizard alien costume on and not actually something that's alien, because it makes it like, oh, no, but this is a meaningful, loving relationship. And I'm like, it's freaky that a human wants to have sex with the lizard. It's like the whole, like, furry kind of thing. It's all like, yeah, but under the dog costume, it is just a human. Still under a there. Human, it's not like you actually want to have sex with a dog, is it? No. But there is, like, this layering of, you know, whatever it's going. Again, and it makes it more believable that I know that at furry conventions, there's sex parties where everyone's dressed up as dogs and zebras, rather than there's a convention where people actually have sex with real dogs and zebras.
Yes.
And there is this I know you're frowning at me, but this is the kind of things that I feel sometimes when I'm reading this, like, you know, like a long way to a, like, I have to make sure that I understand that the author doesn't think it's not freaky for humans to have sex with aliens in some way, and that it's actually, you know, a metaphor for, you know, neurodivergent and mental health or whatever it is going to be. Like, oh, this person's actually standing in for someone who has got this, you know, neurodivergent, whatever. Like,
they're
whatever.
Different. Yeah, it doesn't
they're
matter.
Different. They're different. And they feel like they're different, but they're fitting in. They found their found family and they found someone. And I'm like, this book here, this Illuminous by Sylvia Park is like the anti-found family book.
Yeah.
Because it's actually about family. It's not about found family, which is like the easy way out of like, oh no, just leave your family behind and find new people. It's like, no, families are fucked up. This is about a brother and a sister who grew up with a fucked up, not found family, an implanted family where the father gave them a brother to live with. Mm-hmm. And it's also about kids. And it's also about those kids, like, what are these kids going to grow up to be? Yeah. And have they got a family? And what does it mean that family units exist where one of the parents might be a robot or one of the kids might be a robot. Mm-hmm. Found family, that it's like, no, not found family, real family. Let's go real family. Like, what does it actually mean to have human relationships with things which are inhuman and that is now a normal part of the world? And guess what? Sometimes it's fucked up. Sometimes it's weird. Sometimes you're going to have sex with a robot out of some reason.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you are self-acknowledging in the moment that it's a bit fucked up that I want to have sex with this robot, and maybe I'm going to have to get drunk to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And then when somebody else has sex with a robot later on in the book and the reason's different, you're like, ah, this is because humanity is messy.
Yes.
And the messiness of this book allows for the depth of this book. And I really, really, really appreciate a book which is just allowed to be, it's just relishing in the messiness of the human condition without labeling anyone as sort of like, oh, no, this person's a metaphor for, you know, autism spectrum, and this person's a metaphor for this. It's like, no. Take away all the metaphor. Take away even the metaphor that some people are human and some people are robots and some people are aliens. It's sort of like, this book is so deep just about humanity.
Yeah.
Just an any one of the things that I've talked about could be the depth of an entire novel. But this book is like, oh no, this is also about sexuality. It's also about gender. It's also about family. It's also about, you know, power dynamics. It's about sex. It's about sex workers. It's about domestic abuse. It's about, like, it's about child abuse. This book is about everything. It's about crime. Yeah. It's about politics. It's about technology. It's about, and you're rolling your eyes at me, but that is the kind of thing that I think should be in a book if it's a book which can make which is enough to make me think, or not make me think, but like for me to relish thinking about a book. And as I'm reading it, relishing because I don't know where it's going to go next. Not because it's not predictable, and in some ways I did see where it was going, but like it never allowed me to know how I should be thinking about the next thing that happened.
Yes.
Which is kind of unique when I'm reading a book like this.
Yeah. First of all, two things. I'm not frowning at you because you said something weird. I'm not rolling your eyes because you're saying weird.
Yeah.
I frowned because the idea of that people actually want to have sex with dogs and zebras, that was what I was frowning at.
Yeah, okay. But that was like 4 points
yes,
ago.
Yes, but I couldn't say anything because you just went on like a really long monologue.
Was an analogy. That was a metaphor about how it sometimes it feels to read books. That's all I'm saying.
I know. That is not my point. My point is that you think I'm making impressions because I'm against what you're saying. Yeah. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I think that is a very important point about why books like this work. Because, and here's now what I want to say, is that authors sometimes don't understand what science fiction is. Science fiction is not... It's not foremost about robots, AIs, aliens, and technology. It is foremost about humans.
Yeah.
And the best science fiction authors really get that.
Yeah.
And it is about, you don't need metaphors because humans are weird and strange. You don't need metaphor. You can just describe humans and you get all that.
Yeah. Get your point of view close enough to a desperate character. And the work is done for you.
Exactly. So all you need to do is you just need to observe humans and put them in a certain backdrop.
Right.
And see how they behave in certain situations. Might that be confrontation with an alien? Might that be in front around a society with robots? And that is the interesting thing.
Yeah. And should we go back to Solaris again? Solaris.
Yes, Solaris. And also, or like Red Mars and like these kind of like these books. Like Red Mars, Blue Bars.
Really? I wouldn't put those in the same category at all, but sure.
They are not in the same category. What I'm saying is that they observe humans.
Right. Oh, yes. Okay.
Under certain circumstances.
Yes.
And there is the thing about you just take the politics and the corporations and humans will behave in certain ways.
Yeah.
Just on a different planet.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that it is focusing on humans.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think in this case that Solaris is like one of the, I know it's weird to say, but is a close hit for this for me, is because Solaris never suddenly goes, oh, and here's what the unimaginable, unthinkably great, non-human thought process. It's like we never get to see what it's thinking.
No.
But we do get how
the impact
it,
on the human.
Yes, how it goes, well, it's plucking, it obviously knows me well enough that it's plucking these things out of my memories and creating a human for me to interact with. And I sometimes, in spoilers for Solaris, sometimes try and kill it or live with it or lock it away. This book that's Luminous is positing a similar thing, that it, some things you can create from your own history that then live with you and that you want to lock away. Mm-hmm. That's like, it's like, oh, is it because Sylvia Parker's like, I want to do the thing in Solaris where something from your past comes back and you have to live with it as it is a physical embodiment of trauma in your past. Mm-hmm. How can I do that? Or is Sylvia Park just a good enough writer that they're doing a similar thing to what Solaris is doing, but also with loads of other layers on top of it?
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And that's the kind of reference that I like in science fiction, where it isn't being like, oh, do you remember this Star Trek movie? Reference. It's sort of like, hey, if you've read Solaris recently, you'll understand what it means to have a physical embodiment of past trauma living in your bedroom with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
something
that makes you think, oh yeah, what would it be like to have an embodiment of past trauma embodied into a living being, which isn't human, which maybe I'll try and kill, or maybe I'll strike up a human, you know, relationship with. And Solaris is doing that, and this book is doing that. And not many other books do that kind of thing in such a rich way, which makes you think, you know, with all the things that Solaris makes you think, this book is also capable of making you think. Not all of it, but you know. adjacent.
Is the question, are you suppressing the trauma or are you embracing it and living with it and, you know, this kind of stuff? But overall, I think what it comes down to is you can have a book with as many topics as you just mentioned.
Yeah.
And it feeling cohesive and it makes sense and you connect to it.
Yeah.
Unlike other books where just you have so many topics that are just being thrown in and never really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not only that they're not observed, but also, and you said here in this, in Illuminous, things are also just mentioned on the side. Yeah. But it is, there is reasons for that.
And I think this is the skill, you know, because we mentioned in the previous episode about trope listing. Like, if you just put vampires and werewolves and robots and AI.
And ancient monsters.
And also all of the modern tags as well, like, you know, like neurodiversity, found family, you know, lesbian romance, whatever it's going to be. Like, whatever.
Of course, because in the end, she's going to end up, the werewolf's going to end up with the sexy vampire.
Like, suddenly likes goth girls. Yeah, so all of those trope listings. Now, the cynical way to say would be you could say the same thing about Luminous, this book.
Yeah.
That, it's just a list of the tropes. And you'd be like, yeah, but in this case, it doesn't feel like a list of tropes.
Yes.
It feels like these characters live in a world, and because they live in a real world, lots of things come up.
Yeah.
And if you're going to concentrate on the weirdest family with the closest ties to the robot and with the interesting family, there's going to be lots of topics there. You know, it. Of course there is going to be history there. Of course there is going to be weird stuff, or not weird stuff, but it doesn't feel, it doesn't feel forced. It feels like it's just a rich world.
Yes.
So in the opposite way of some of these other recent books, what was the other one? Oh, yeah, Ian and Banks' Inversions. I was like, you can't list tropes there because there's three topics and then it's just a character study. This book's the opposite way. It's suddenly there's 18 topics, mm-hmm. but it also it's a character study, or, you know, it's a deep character study of these, I'd say, 3 to 4 main characters where you really get into their brains.
Yeah.
And some of them are human brains.
How long is it? Is this a big book?
No. Put it this way. One of the negative parts of this book that I would say is that the pacing is a bit off.
Mm-hmm.
But none of it is wasted, but it does take a bit of time. There is a bit of meandering around at some points in terms of plot and story and pacing.
Okay.
But it's not a big knock on it. Mm-hmm. It's really not a big knock on it.
Okay.
But at one point I felt this could probably have been 3 chapters shorter.
Okay.
But it's not a long book. Let's have a look on the page here, on the Goodreads page. Yeah, 391 pages hardcover. So yeah, okay. a chunky enough book.
Yeah. I've definitely seen a chunkier.
Yeah, but I read it as an ebook, so I didn't really get a feel of it. Like, when I'm listening to an audiobook, I have hours. And if I've got a paper book, it's how chunky it is. Yes. An ebook, you're just next.
Yeah, I know. So, I know that feeling too well. Right.
Last note is... Oh, yeah. The last point about the most important part, which is that we're not close up to the robots, is that the belief in their humanity or not humanity can be suspended in a way that if their thoughts are described, it couldn't be. So here's what I'm trying to say there, just to clarify this point, is that we can make decisions about how human or not a robot is, or how important the humanity of a robot is mm-hmm. to their rights as a being.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because they pass as more human that we mm-hmm. should care for them and have empathy for them more or not? So it's that kind of thing, the older models of robots, are they
less worthy?
Are they less worthy? You know, that kind of thing. But it's now, because we're not in the thoughts of the robot and it's all reflected through human characters perceiving the robots, mm-hmm. we as readers don't have the strict parameters of this robot is human enough and therefore you should care about it and think about it. And this robot is not human enough and therefore it can just be used as a weapon mm-hmm. or it can be used as a sex
as an object.
Or it can be just discarded, beaten up, not like... If it's stolen, it's just property. Mm-hmm. It's not human. If it's beaten up, if it's destroyed in a bad way.
It's not its own entity.
Yes, it's property damage, not... aggravated assault or whatever it is like that. And because we have that distance, we as readers are allowed to make those decisions ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That yes, this is a lesser thing. So should I care as much about this robot or is this other robot? Or should I care about the robot characters as much as the human characters? And that kind of stuff. I think it's just, I just want to leave it at that, this review on that note. Because I'm not sure if that's what Sylvia Park is doing specifically, but whatever decision she made worked really well for me.
Yeah.
Which brings me to author's note at the end. This started off as a children's book, and then as it got out of control, it's all like, this is not a children's book.
After the book
finishes, it's all like, author's note, thanks to my agent, thanks to, you know, my copy editor or whatever it is. Also, this book started off as a children's book, but it obviously isn't a children's book. But that's why, that's why there are so many children in it, and it's about growing up, and it's about relationships, and it's about family, which I appreciate. And also, Sylvia Park is Korean but American. Actually, let me just quickly look on it. Here. If I look here on her Goodreads page. Probably wrong pronouns here. They teach fiction at the University of Kansas and split themselves between Lawrence and Seoul. So someone who is partly in South Korea, partly in America. What's this? Clarion Science Fiction and Fantasy Workshop. So part of what we would think of as like Tor Wave, you know, is published on these different things.
Have you read a book by them before?
No, this is the first novel.
Oh, okay.
I think so. Don't know. It's the top book that comes up here. There's some of these others as well, but I don't know. Is this a novel or is this a short story? 32 pages. Yeah, so it looks like maybe some novellas and some short stories in this collection here as well. Mm-hmm. Some of the best from Tor.com, 2019 edition. Yeah, so it's like short stories, maybe some novellas, and this is the first novel.
Good.
But what I'm saying is, what I like about this is that the position or the character of... the backstory... The life of the author is being reflected well because the main characters aren't 100% Korean or not in the same way, that there's such a big influence of America in their thought process that there isn't any moment where, some of the main characters, there's not a moment where they're like, and now I'm going to represent all of unified Korea in the future with someone who is 100% there and all of that. It's sort of like, no, bringing in, and I appreciate that from someone who is writing about Korean culture, but from an American point of view.
Yeah.
And it never rubbed me up the wrong way that some of the viewpoint characters felt very American rather than Korean. Not because I'm invested in Korean characters or viewpoints. It just feels more relatable in a way that like some of these other books were sort of like, oh yes, this book is set in 1200 in what's
Japan.
Now Oman or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, but these are just Americans but happening to be hanging out 800 years ago in the Middle East, and they're all Muslims, but they're all indistinguishable from, you know, whatever it is. You know what I'm trying to say?
I understand what you're saying.
I appreciate the closeness of
It's bridging
author.
Also. It's bridging very much to the target audience, which certainly will be the English-speaking world. It wasn't originally written in Korean.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. It's an American novel. It's an American novel that's set in a future science fictional unified Korea, which is interesting because I looked at some of these reviews on Goodreads, and somebody said, somebody was obviously like, oh, as somebody who also has Korean heritage, I wanted to get more about Korea from this book, and I didn't. And I was like, okay, I understand that. Yes. I understand that point of view.
Yes.
So anyway, I think I'm going to give this book 5 stars. I think it's very good.
Nice.
However, just to say, the overall rating on Goodreads, 3.64, which is super low.
Yes.
Because I don't think everybody wants a book as messy as this.
Yes.
And I appreciated the messiness of this book.
Yeah.
Which it felt like it was like, it feels like it's the opposite of these clear books, which are like, actually what I'm doing is just describing what it would feel like to be watching an episodic TV show about this character.
Yeah.
And this book is the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, well, stuff's happening. Keep up. You know, I'll just mention something and maybe in 300 pages it'll come back in. But if you weren't paying attention the first time, good luck, really.
Yeah.
You know, stuff's going to happen. Like some of the most important things are going to happen off screen, yeah, like off the page,
yes,
and some character is just going to mention something, and you're like, oh, it's possible to do that, to have like the most important things that are happening in the entire story are just somebody finds out about them later and like, wait, what happened?
Yeah, because you know what? That's what happens in life.
Yeah,
because
it's really good.
So many things happen outside of what you do or think or in your circle,
yeah,
that you just have to react to and live with. I wanted to ask how many ratings there are. Like, what is the basis?
Oh, yeah, we can
basis?
Look at it now, can't we?
How many?
2,574
ratings.
See, that's
also not a lot.
No, no, it's not a big popular book.
Yeah.
I mean, it won the what used to be called the James Tiptree Junior Award,
mm-hmm,
which is for like, you know, women and queer science fiction. It won that award, but that award has a different name now. I'd need to look it up.
Actually,
it's probably I was going to say it's probably
in the
listed
top
here
somewhere.
Isn't it? Awards. It read the no, it doesn't actually say it here. I think, is it called the Otherwise Award? I looked it up. Yeah, the Otherwise Award, which, mm-hmm, used to be called the, formerly the Tiptree Award.
Right.
And that's what this one, it's to expand and explore, a speculative fiction that expands and explores our understanding of gender.
Okay.
And this book just won it.
Cool.
Is the latest. I think they it's not just one book per year. I think they can do multiple. But it's been renamed because Tiptree. People are like, hey, wait a second. This is someone who had like a murder suicide ending to their story. Do we want the book to be?
Yeah.
Do we want our major award to be named after someone who killed their husband and then themselves or whatever happened there,
yes,
as well? So
yeah.
I looked at the Wikipedia page,
okay,
about it.
Interesting. I've not heard of the Otherwise Award. But
yes,
thanks
because
so much.
You might have seen something winning the
Tiptree Award.
The Tiptree Award, and that's it.
I just wanted to say it keeps popping up. I'm seeing the cover when you scroll through the pages here, and I think that cover does look very Philip K. Dick-ish, like.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, it's very the tiger there as well. Yes.
Yeah.
It's fun. Yeah, it's like some of the Korean culture that comes in is fun. Like this tiger turns up and you're like, oh, that's the tiger. That's probably the tiger from Demon Hunters, K-pop Demon Hunters.
Yeah.
There's like a derpy tiger turns up. And at the end of this book, a derpy tiger turns up and you're like, oh, derpy tiger.
Uh-huh.
So, yes.
Cool.
So Tiptree Award. Here it is. In 2019, controversy arose over the appropriateness of naming award after Tiptree. In 1987, Alice Sheldon shot and killed her ailing husband, Huntington Sheldon, before killing herself in the same manner. So, although some have called the killing a suicide pact based on Sheldon's personal writing, her story, others characterize the act as caregiver murder, i.e. the murder of a disabled person by the person responsible for caring for them.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this book, not associated with Tiptree Jr., James Tiptree or Alice Sheldon, but in fact, otherwise, just named.
Okay.
So it is an award-winning
book.
Good
to know. Nice. All right. I might want to read that. It sounds...
might want to read it. I'm just saying there are reasons why this book only gets 3.64 stars on General and Goodreads.
Yeah.
And
but I'm up for all kinds of books.
Yeah.
Look, the books I'm currently reading couldn't be more different. And I think this would fit quite nicely in amongst those.
Yeah, yeah. And it also won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Speculative Fiction for last year. And now it's got a Locus Award nomination for first novel, pending, hasn't won yet.
Nice.
Anyway, I think it's very good.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give it 5 stars.
Cool.
A very rare 5-star book for me, but honestly, the best new book that I've read for quite a while. And that's after reading some other books, which I was like, hey, this is one of the best books new books that I've read for a while. But
yeah,
this is what comes from trying out the accumulated best of list highlights from other people's best of lists.
Yes. And not just follow one list blindly.
So yeah. I'm not going to just go with Hugo nominee voters. I'm like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Can't even get.
No more Hugular.
Well, again, some books are good and also win Hugo wins.
Yes.
I think Shroud might have a good shout this time
out
because Adrian Chaikovsky is not going up against himself.
Yeah.
And some people might look at that and be like, hey, what's all this fantasy doing? Isn't it time for science fiction to win a book, win an award? So it might be science fiction's turn and we'll have a science fiction author rather than a fantasy book because like all of these other ones are fantasy.
Yeah.
I think.
That sounds good.
Isn't it fantasy? That Death of the Author is not fantasy. So Death of the Author and Shroud are the two science clear. Fiction, clearly science fiction books rather than fantasy books.
Yes.
So maybe it's science fiction's turn, and then I think Shroud might be in with a chance. But who knows?
Nice. All right.
Let's wrap it up there.
I wanted to give a shout out to the listeners who write emails.
Oh yes, thank you very much, Alex.
I never know what the emails are that you forward to me, but
yeah.
Recently you forwarded me a few.
Well, I think it's because I mentioned emails on the podcast and then other people emailed in. So
I appreciate that. Thank you so much for everybody who sent messages and what kind of impact the podcast has, how long they listen, and any recommendations.
Yes, and thank you, Alex. I'm sorry.
Definitely reading all of them.
If I said he or and it's a shit, I just don't know. I don't know. Alex, yeah. Who knows?
I looked up.
Oh, you looked? I didn't.
On Goodreads. And okay. Anyway, and there were other emails as well. And people appreciate if we shout out their ratings and reviews on,
yes.
On Goodreads.
Let's have a look. Okay, Luminous. Go down.
Has any friend?
Yeah, there's 13 friends and followers here.
Nice.
So David Agranoff said 5 stars. Some interesting thoughts there. I'm not going to read it out. It's a bit too long. Ellison, 5 stars. B, 3.5 stars. And Gregory Rothbard, 4 stars. So, and then one other person rated it 3 stars. Kevin Zhu? I guess. And then a few other people have it on their to read list. So in other words, people who've actually rated this
highly
book
regarded
is 5 stars, 5 stars, 3.5 stars, 4 stars and 3 stars. So
that's pretty good.
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah.
Gregory says, I really enjoyed this novel. There were times the narrative was oblique and hard to follow, but overall the tale creates a near future that seems plausible. I really like the Korean aspect of the novel as well. So,
nice.
B said 3.5 stars. I feel this should or could have been excellent, but somehow it never quite landed the setup. The language was often beautiful, complex metaphors abound. It was an emotional book full of old trauma skirting around the inability to love or be loved.
Hmm.
The analogies with robots was never rubbed in your face. It was subtle and quite often lovely, but also cold and distant, like seeing the story unfold through lead glass, even when you are in someone's point of view. This is what I'm saying. Like, there's this distance between you and what's going on,
mm-hmm.
that the lead glass is always sort of like, if somebody didn't notice something, you don't get to know. If someone is concentrating on this thing, you get to know it. If they're fleetingly thinking about this history, that's mentioned, otherwise not, in something like that.
Makes sense.
Cool. The disjointed new unified Korean was really rich background to the whole story. So anyway, yeah, that's it.
Nice.
It's good stuff.
That's very good.
Are we alive? How are we alive? What is memory and what are we without it? This is Ellison. In what ways is a robot or computer program alive or not? These are the questions that are central to Luminous, and Park deals with them in that way, though a little over the top at times. That's what I'm saying. Sometimes there's a little over the top. You're like, wow, we're just going straight to melodrama. It's like, yeah, we are. This is we're going to soap opera this up. And I'm like, give me more soap opera with robots.
I like that.
And then, yeah, some bit of passages from the book there as well.
Nice.
And yes, and then David says, Luminous is a deeply thoughtful science fiction novel with grounded and fully realized characters. The setting is powerful. The themes are rich with emotional depth. One of the best reads I have had this year. So thank you, David. You wrote way too much for me to read that out, but he read it back in August last year. So thank you very much, other SFBRP listeners, for letting me see what you think about this book.
That's good.
I agree with you guys who gave it 5 stars. And also, actually, I agree with the people who didn't give it 5 stars,
yeah.
Because also I totally agree that this novel is intentionally opaque in some ways.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, a reason why for me it gets 5 stars and in general it gets, was it 3.64 stars, which is a pretty low rating.
Yes.
What do I say? The average rating is 3.5 to 4.5, you know, and it lays on this. But so,
yeah.
By, yeah, this should be
if
a
you just,
1 star.
You just,
but,
no, yeah.
This should be like a 0.8 something book, 8.8 book,
yeah,
or 6, whatever. Either way,
I'm currently reading 2 books.
Do you want to talk about them now?
Simultaneously,
mention them now. Yeah,
I'm reading How Spacesuit Will Travel.
Oh yeah, me too. I'm also reading that,
and
book.
I'm probably going to finish it within the next few days.
Okay, I'll get on with it.
And I'm also reading Play of Games again. And I'm like 60% through the book.
Yes, that's a bit of a slower read than How Spacesuit Will Travel, maybe.
Yeah, no. I mean, I'm
just a getting book.
To, yeah, it's just a bigger, way bigger book. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, let me have a quick look over here as well. The books that I am currently have finished and haven't done a review of yet is, oh, yeah, Luminous, this book, War of the Worlds, which, again, is just sitting there because I want to do an episode about it at some point. Have Spacesuit with Travel, which is what I'm currently reading. Oh, yeah, and then Lives of Bitter Rain and Days of Shattered Faith, which is Adrian Tchaikovsky fantasy series, which I'm about a third of the way through the third major book in the series.
So, yeah, you want to do another episode once you've finished the trilogy.
Yeah, so there's a trilogy plus a novella. I've reviewed the first two books, and now this next one is going to be reviewing the novella and the third book in the series, which is it's like a direct continuation. I'm like, I'm really glad that I read the novella first, because it's like, the novella happens, the same characters, one more character turns up, and you're like, oh, we're just sticking with the same it's the same character. I'm so glad that I read it in the order, even if the publishing order is slightly different.
Good.
But it did feel like he just had, the novel was a bit long, and was like, this novel should be a bit shorter. Tell you what, let's just chop off this 150 pages from the start, call it a novella, and then put a novel after, and then the rest of the story can be a novel. So that's what
makes
it feels like, which I'll do a full review of that in a few weeks' time when I've finished that
great
chunky book. Well, that's it, an hour and 15 minutes. That's like the standard length for us, isn't it?
Yes.
All right, we can stop, we can get lunch in a minute, and I've got to go
yes,
and
please
maybe head into Berlin and get a new phone.
Let's see,
my phone isn't coping very well. What are you doing? We're going to say, follow me on Blue
yes,
Sky.
Yes, exactly.
Email me, luke@juggler.net. I'm on Instagram. Julianne is around too, at JUKU Berlin. I'm at Luke Burridge in various different places.
And become our friends on Goodreads.
Yeah, become our friends on Goodreads. And support us on Patreon. Patreon.com/Luke Burridge for mostly juggling stuff, but also juggling podcasts. Our other podcast is over on Patreon.
Yeah.
It's a Patreon exclusive, which means we don't publish it anywhere else except on Patreon.
Except you do.
Oh, yeah, it's on YouTube as well. Either way, follow along for fun juggling content and sporadic science fiction book review podcast content. That's it from us. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.